then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a man the chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's November the 18th, 2010. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. No real Edgar Steele update this week. Cindy Steele did a very good interview with Jamie Kelso of the White News Now website. You can hear that interview by going to www.whitenewsnow.com. That's whitenewsnow, all one word, .com. Like I said in the last broadcast, the regime is basically waiting us out, waiting until they think everybody's lost interest in the Steele case and gone home, so they can slip him in and out of court and on into prison with no one noticing and no one paying too much attention. The trial has been postponed until March the 7th, but when you think about it, there's no real reason for that. I mean, what's their case? Larry Fairfax and the tapes. That's it. The jury will either believe Larry Fairfax and the tapes or they won't. Is there going to be any change in that basic situation between now and the 7th of March, 4 months from now? Or is the delay to give the government time to clean up the mess and find some way so they don't have to name the third man, the guy who went with Larry Fairfax to Oregon to check on the bomb he'd placed on Cindy Steele's car? The third hired killer that the FBI tried to frighten Cindy Steele with in order to make her shut up and not support her husband in public. Are they maybe looking for time to put every conceivable pressure on Ed Steele to break and cop a plea? You know, by March the 7th, Steele will have been in prison for 9 months. I wouldn't be surprised to see the government offer him time served if he cops a plea. Anything so they don't actually have to stand up and prove something in court. We just have to hope Ed is strong enough to stand up to them. Okay, moving on to another, possibly boring subject, I'm going to read you guys a couple of emails now. Those of you who are on the Northwest Revolution list have already seen these, but most of our listeners won't have. Once more, I'm getting hit with this business of, oh, Harold, you're too negative. You should be upbeat and inspiring us all, like that song from Life of Brian about always look on the bright side of life. Onward and upward! Better living through chemistry! Excelsior! You get the idea. Anyway, on Monday I got an email from Comrade Tom in California, which I won't read in its entirety, but he concluded, Harold, I hope that people don't just sit around waiting for novel number 5 and doing nothing. We don't need vampires just sucking you dry, and when you die, move on to the next thing. I was in a bit of a philosophical mood, and so I replied to Tom, and I copied the rest of the list as well as follows. Realistically, Tom, I don't know what more I can do with what I have to work with. I don't have followers. I have an audience. I am essentially in a form of show business. The whole history of my activity since the end of the old days in the 80s has been everybody sitting around waiting for Harold to pull a rabbit out of a hat so they can applaud. Northwest Novel No. 5 is definitely the last one. After this, there really are no more rabbits in my hat. If a small number of us, about 1,000 of us to be precise, can't transform our character and begin actually to do things, then after this last book, I'm pretty much done. I'm kind of like a busker, one of those guys playing the guitar or the zither or something outside the subway stations or on the street with his instrument case open on the ground in front of him. If they like my tune, people passing by on the way to somewhere else in their busy and all-important personal lives throw coins into the case as a tip. The tips have been enough so far to keep me alive and out of the Salvation Army homeless shelter, so I shouldn't complain. But you know, we could really do this thing if we actually believe that it can be done. And that's what drives me nuts. It can be done far more easily and far less bloodily than anyone realizes if we could just get our minds right. Oh, well, what are you going to do? Signed, HAC. Now, personally, I think I was just stating the obvious, especially since I've never claimed to be some kind of man on a white horse who's going to lead the charge. Maybe I could be like Teddy in Arsenic and Old Lace, yelling, "Charge!" blowing a bugle and running up the stairs. But this one guy got that email, and he went absolutely ballistic. He sent me a rocket back, hollering that my comments were, quote-unquote, too negative, and, quote-unquote, it did not inspire. Well, no, probably not. I wasn't feeling especially inspirational. I was simply telling it like it is. The truth is neither negative nor positive. It simply is. I've never seen any particular merit in the kind of self-deception that most of the white racial resistance movement practices on itself. Okay, you might say that my Northwest novels are a form of self-deception, and I would disagree. I would say that they're a possible vision of things that might come to pass if we can ever get our act together, but still, I can see the objection. And that all too many people tend to substitute the fantasy for real-life action. The way things work out in real life, in actual practice, is usually something like this. People come into our circle, they hang around with us on the internet for a bit, waiting for great things magically to appear for their entertainment and their edification, and when this doesn't happen after a certain length of time, however long or short their attention span is, they wander away in search of fresh sensation and stimulation for their jaded mental and emotional palates. In other words, most of the people who get into the NF on the internet are Americans. They're capable of being intensely interested and enthusiastic about anything for 15 minutes. This is what I was discussing in one of my earlier emails this week about my job requirements for an assistant, the absolute assurance that he or she is going to stick with it, which is something that no white person these days can guarantee. And most people in my audience, because I say again, that's what it is, are in essence waiting for me to, quote-unquote, do something. I've never been quite sure what. I guess people just assume that I have some kind of magic beans in my pocket and I can just drop them on the ground and cause a revolution to leap up out of the earth like Jack's beanstalk. Every now and then I do get a vague glimpse of what this mysterious something I'm supposed to do is. Apparently, something in people's minds involves me standing in front of a big crowd, making some kind of impassioned speech, or maybe on live national television, which I'd be quite willing to do if anyone can ever come up with a crowd willing to listen to me, or some way to get the media to point the TV cameras at me without us making a fool of ourselves, and without anybody getting killed or going to prison. I'm working on that, but so far I haven't found the secret formula yet. I think some people, still in the back of their minds, envision me wearing a costume of some kind while I'm making this impassioned speech to the crowd or on TV, possibly the uniform of a Napoleonic dragoon or something, and that ain't going to happen. Anyway, as nearly as I can determine, once this impassioned speech of mine is concluded, everybody will run around hollering and waving their arms in the air for a bit, and then everything will be cool, and we'll have a white paradise here in the Northwest, and we can pay for everyone to move here and provide moving vans and crew so nobody will have to do any work, and we can give everybody in our audience jobs and houses and, for all I know, a leprechaun and a pot of gold. Now, I'm not joking, people. Most of you out there who even pretend to believe that revolution is possible seem to have no more advanced notion or vision as to how the Republic is supposed to come about than what I've just said. Yeah, I know everybody's read the Northwest novels, but surely Harold doesn't expect anybody to do anything like that, I mean, right? I mean, that would be foolish and dangerous. The big bad policeman might hurt us. Oh, something else. I'm also supposed to magically convert all the local white people into Jerry Rebs and do it with no money and no help so that outside people can just stroll on into the Northwest with everything already done for them. And all the picnic tables will be set up and the cakes and ale set out and they won't have to exert any effort or do any heavy lifting. Okay, I get it, guys. I know you're Americans and you've been taught all your lives to avoid effort, to flee from it. Remember the old American motto, don't work hard, work smart, which is another way of saying, find some way to get someone else to do all the heavy lifting and take all the risk while you get the credit and the gravy. Kind of the basic principle of capitalism there. I really am trying to find some way to get all or most of the heavy lifting done for all of our people in Florida and Georgia and New York and Kansas who assure me that next year, oh, next year for sure. Next year, absolutely, for sure, they'll be coming home. It's just going real slow, kind of a vicious cycle. Until these guys get their asses up here, we can't really do any of the heavy lifting, and until the heavy lifting's done, they won't come. Catch 22. The very idea, any concept at all, that it is you guys in my audience who should be actively participating up to and including and past the point of personal inconvenience and even risk is conspicuous by its absence. Oh, sure, most all of you who bother to get in contact do give lip service to the idea of coming home. You kind of have to in order to stay on the list and keep the entertainment coming. But we both know you're not serious. I can always tell who the very few serious people we have are because they're here, where they're supposed to be. And if most of you were serious, you'd be here as well. It takes a year at most to organize a cross-country move. We have a lady in Seattle who did it in 3 months, and at least two people I know who said, to hell with it, got in their cars and just started driving. Anyone who's serious about coming here is going to do it, and it's not going to take them long at all. Now, let me digress a bit here on this subject. I just got a comment on one of the blogs from a young man from Florida who said that he'd piled all his stuff in his car in Miami, and he'd taken off for Washington, in November no less, and he was now here in Washington with $500 in his pocket, and he was going to prosper. Well, that's great, son. I really, you know, wish you all the best, and I wish that you had contacted us beforehand because we could have made it all a lot easier for you. And I will say, okay, $500 is a bit, well, not quite enough, I don't think. People sometimes ask me how much you should bring. My personal view is that when you're making an inner city move of any kind, you should have at least $2,000 in your kick for first and last month's rent, deposits on utilities, that sort of stuff. It takes about a year to save that up on even a minimum wage salary. Anyway, this kid apparently, according to what he said, just tossed everything in his car and headed on up here. Well, more power to him. We will certainly do everything we can to help him, but son, you need to get in touch with us. My email is nwnet@earthlink.net. Get in touch with me if you're listening to this, and we'll see if we can bring you in from the cold, quite literally. Anyway, like I said, anyone who's serious about coming here is going to do it, and it's not going to take them long at all, as witness this young man I've just referred to. Now, these are the facts. Facts can never be positive or negative or insulting or even inspiring. Facts simply are. They're the foundation on which one builds other things, good and bad. Now, so long as this situation that I've just described pertains, so long as there is no sense of urgency, so long as there is no concept of the Northwest Migration as something you do rather than something you watch or listen to on a computer or read about in a book, there will be no progress towards a Northwest American Republic, and the white race is still headed for physical extinction around the year 2100. I've pretty much given up making excuses or trying to explain why we white people, and especially we white people who claim to be racial nationalists, are the way we are. It is what it is. We will change, or 100 years from now, there won't be any more white people. Two choices, that's it. I'm sorry if the truth does not inspire. But if you get right down to it, the fact is that nothing I do or say seems to inspire anyone to the kind of participatory reaction that must occur if there is to be any hope for our race to continue to exist. Okay, obviously I get lucky sometimes, as with that guy I just described who came all the way up here from Miami on $500, and he's wandering around out there somewhere. Now, I've been upbeat before. I've more or less said, give me an N, give me an O, give me an R, so forth and so on, right up to, yay, Northwest, in more or less those terms sometimes. It kind of freaks me out that it honestly doesn't seem to matter what I do or say. Now, those who like the show, so to speak, both literally and figuratively, are going to keep on listening and applauding and supporting. They're just not actually going to come here. Those who don't like it are a perpetually grumpy and insane minority of people with some weird obsession about me, and nothing I could ever do or say could persuade them to come home, even if it was October 22nd and the tricolor flag was raising over Longview. White people have to change our thinking and our behavior, or we die. It's that simple, and most of us seem to be good with that, rather than undergo any personal risk or inconvenience. Now, that's where we stand right now. I'm not quite sure what the purpose would be for me to pretend otherwise. Now, we have a perfectly legal and actually beneficial act, Northwest Migration, with which our people can signify their commitment to racial survival and their return to the real world for that purpose. Now, I'm seeing a lot of promises. What I am not seeing is out-of-state license plates coming over the hill. That's where we are right now. You will change it, or we will perish from the face of the earth. I'm sorry if this doesn't inspire, but what possible purpose would it serve for me to lie about it, or to lie about it by omission? I just don't see the point in pretending that our character problems don't exist, because they are so important, and I don't see the point in refusing to acknowledge that character is, in fact, our biggest problem. Oh, while I'm thinking about it, on one of the blogs last week, we had somebody complain that if we put all the white people in one place, like the Northwest, then that means it would be all that much easier for the United States to bomb us all. Someone else, whose name escapes me because I think I accidentally hit the wrong key and deleted the comment, for which I apologize, made a very good point. We are not being bombed, we are being bred out. The threat to white people's existence is not because the blacks and the Mexicans and the government are killing us, although they are, but because white women are not having children, or else white couples are waiting until their 30s and they're only having one child. That is the threat against our people's existence, and it doesn't come from the niggers or the beaners or the feds or even the bugger boys. It comes from the contents of our own hearts and minds and the degree to which those hearts and minds have been poisoned with narcissism and selfishness and laziness and cowardice and refusal to grow up and take responsibility, and that applies to both white men and women. I think I'm doing passably well so far for having ad-libbed this whole thing, so I better go to the first music break. Someone complained recently that I have not yet played any Wagner on this show. No, I haven't. And it's not because I don't like Wagner, but classical music as a whole is generally not suitable for formats like this. Most of the really nice pieces are too long. A Ride of the Valkyries is about 5.5 minutes long, which is a bit too long, I think, for this show. But in any case, hell, we've all heard Ride of the Valkyries. No point in playing that one. Another problem is that many good, short classical cuts start out very soft, and they build up to a very loud crescendo, kind of like this one. This is Richard Wagner, The Hall of the Mountain King. Okay, before we leave the goo-boo stuff, one quick comment here on something that's become an issue over the past few days. I'm going to talk about this because several other people have reported back to me that they're experiencing the same problem with Occidental Descent as well as with some other so-called intellectual racist publications and websites. Now, this is an email I got from Terry in Florida. Dear HAC, I don't know what's going on, but I've tried more than once to post positive comments about the Northwest Initiative, the Northwest Quartet, and your podcasts over at Occidental Descent, and they don't make it past the moderator. Are those who own and run the OD more goat dancers who can't distinguish personality from purpose? They tell me I violated the terms for posting, in spite of the fact that my posts are more factual and professional than most of what they do post. I thought you'd been well received there. Guess I'm wrong again. I don't post much anymore, and I find this most aggravating. I mean, goddammit, this is for the species, boys and girls, and I don't give a shit about personalities. Harold, I say this as someone who does indeed greatly respect you, and yes, I've read all the bullshit online about you. I don't care if you have the personality of Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm or Snidely Whiplash. That ain't the point. You ain't the point. The goddamn cause is the point. The 14 words are the point. When are these assholes going to quit revolving around their own navels? I dare say that even Adolf Hitler himself had people in his ranks who utterly detested him as an individual, but still fought and died for the cause. Jesus Christ, can't they see the clock of our destiny as a people ticking down to the last minute? These assholes act like their internet world is a big fucking deal, for crying out loud. Sorry, I'm just pissed and ranting right now. You've got more important things to do than read this shit. I'll have a check in the mail for the fall building campaign today. Terry, yeah, I looked this exchange over, and it's pretty much what I expected. No surprises. As a general rule, whenever this happens on any so-called intellectual racist website or blog or whatever, disregard what they say about me personally. It's not about me. They don't know me. The people who are doing this to your posts at Occidental Descent have never met me. They wouldn't know me from Adam's house cat if I walked into the room, and I don't know them. As petty and spiteful as a lot of this sounds, in the long run, this is not about personalities. It's about competition. First off, just to clarify, you're confusing Occidental Descent with Occidental Quarterly Online, and I'm no longer received well there either since Greg Johnson left. Occidental Quarterly is, I believe, run by an elderly Southern gentleman named Sam Dixon, who back in the day used to be one of the few attorneys who would defend white nationalists in the courts, and for that he deserves full credit, and I've always had a lot of personal respect for Sam. But he and the men on the so-called board of Occidental Quarterly are in their 70s and 80s. They're very old dogs who find it very hard to learn new tricks. And they flipped out over the interview that Greg published with me on Occidental Quarterly Online, wherein I mentioned that I am still a National Socialist. Now, Greg refused to knuckle under. He demanded editorial freedom, and they fired him and pulled the article. And by the way, if anyone's interested in reading that article, I'll be glad to send them a copy. It was a little more complicated than that, but basically that's what happened. By the way, Greg is now running a new web journal of pro-white thoughts called Countercurrents. Occidental Descent, I think, although I may be wrong about this, is in some way associated with Professor Kevin MacDonald, in that he writes a lot of the lead articles, but so far as I'm aware, he doesn't actually run the site, and let me make absolutely clear that I am not in any way imputing the problems you're having on the site to Professor MacDonald. For all I know, he may not even be aware that the Northwest Imperative exists. And of course, in view of my inability to get any significant number of people to pack the moving van and come home so far, a good case can be made that we don't. I sent Professor MacDonald a full set of Northwest novels a couple of years ago, and I never heard back from him. What you have to understand, Terry, is that we Northwesters are absolute anathema, pure poison to effete intellectual racists, of which there are a number, especially now that the internet grants them safety and anonymity and they've come into full bloom. They're scared shitless of us. Basically, we're radical, we're extreme, we rock the boat, we tend to get attention, we are quote-unquote violent, or we, quote-unquote, advocate violence and illegality, and we might get people who associate with us in trouble. And that's fair enough. These things are more or less true. If your own personal safety and your own respectability is what concerns you more than the fate of your race and civilization, you probably should stay the hell away from the Northwest Front. We threaten to take the movement off the internet. True, we're not having much success so far. But the threat and the potential for doing so is enough. Remember, Everyone, from the federal government to the ADL to the intellectual racists in our own ranks, are afraid of us. Not for what we're doing. I'm the first to admit we're not doing that much so far. But for the incredible power and potential of the Northwest idea. The Northwest imperative will work, and we can win if we ever get our act together. Our enemies can see that very clearly, even if most of our own people can't. We threaten to take the racial resistance movement out of the nice, safe cyber groves of academe and the little hidey holes in private quarterly journals with the circulation of 600 or 700 copies, and the highfalutin websites and blogs where the intellectual racists have their little circle jerks and send each other long, long letters and emails that no one ever reads, and make long, abstruse blog posts that no one ever reads in order to show off to each other how fucking brilliant they are. These Mr. Peabody intellectual racist types are kind of like peacocks comparing their plumage at the bottom of a well. More to the point, we are competition. However imperfect, however imperfectly formed, the Northwest Front does offer a radical alternative that involves physical action, or in theory at least, will eventually involve action. And the theory is all the intellectual racists care about. That's the threat to them. The Northwest Front is something that intellectual racists can't afford to allow to happen, because if the whole consciousness of the white race is ever united behind one movement with a tangible and achievable goal, then their long, long intellectual and erudite blog posts will be even more irrelevant than they are already. Your average man hates to think of himself as a coward, which is why most average men dabble with us. Because they want to at least convince themselves that they're doing something about the crisis so they won't feel bad about themselves. The intellectual racist, on the other hand, can't stand the idea that he's irrelevant, that his own ego and his own intellect are not the paramount force in the world, that there is a plan, and that there is an idea that will work, and that someone else thought of it. Finally, we are competition in more than the intellectual sense. You need to understand that the main reason why there's so much infighting between organized white racial groups is not so much personalities, although we do certainly have a very high asshole factor, but in the end, it all boils down to one basic bone of contention. We are all scrambling for the same buck. You concluded your letter, Terry, by saying that you would be sending out a contribution check for the NF's fall building campaign. Thank you very much, by the way. That's money that you will not be donating to Occidental Descent, or Stormfront, or VNN, or one of Willis Cardo's many fronts. They want that money. They want that check. And they're pissed off at me for taking the bread out of their mouths as they see it. I wish it was different, guys. I really do. I wish we were different people. Boy, do I ever wish it. I wish we weren't like this, but we are. We've always been like this ever since I first came in. It is what it is. I've learned to accept it and work around it. Now, speaking of money, I got a very interesting email yesterday from Martin in Michigan. Dear HAC, I know you say we have to deal with race and not economics, but I have a question. I was looking over your Northwest Constitution on your website, and I wasn't clear about one thing. I see that you ban lawyers and professional clergymen, which is great, because that will eliminate about 50% of the bullshit in society. At last, somebody gets it! However, I'm not clear on one thing. In the Northwest American Republic, would there be a stock exchange? Very, very good question, Martin. I'm really cheered up when I see signs like this that there are some young people who are paying attention. Okay, I'm going to anticipate the very kind of problem I was talking about with novel number 5 here. I'm going to go out on a limb, and I'm going to give you an immediate gut reaction, which will probably get me in trouble. I'm going to say no, no stock exchange. Now, this does not mean that in the Northwest American Republic you can't have a privately owned business and sell shares in it. What it means is that you can't create an entire industry out of the buying and selling of pieces of paper, an industry that does not involve the actual creation of something substantial that the nation needs. No one will be allowed to create an entire parasitic profession, i.e. stockbrokers, where money alone generates money. That's the essence of the Jewish usury system. Money generating more money without any actual production of goods or provision of valuable services. We've developed a very bad habit in America. We've come to believe that only capitalism can create wealth and prosperity, which isn't true. And we've come to confuse capitalism with freedom, which damn sure isn't true. Always remember, it is capitalism that has brought the illegal aliens here. There is a very distinct difference between capitalism and free enterprise, and a large part of it has to do with what I just mentioned, usury, i.e. money producing more money without anything real or useful being manufactured or harvested or provided. Now, if I tried to go into all the nuances of this, I'd be here all night, but let me try to summarize it in a couple of short sentences. Free enterprise produces wealth. Capitalism produces money. There is a difference between wealth and money. Let's see if I can give you the Cliff Notes version here. Okay, I know some of you detest my habit of going off into long, obscure historical digressions here. Now, being Americans, most of you are only vaguely aware that we have a past at all, and you can't really comprehend anything that happened before you were about 5 or 6 years old and you can start to remember stuff. I don't hold that against you. You can't help it. It's the way the Jews engineered you. But before we can know where we're going, we have to know where we are. And before we can know where we are, we have to understand where we've been and how we got here. Before we can understand the Northwest Republic's solution for the economic woes of capitalist society, we must first understand the way in which our present form of usury-generated finance capitalism arose in the Middle Ages and the early Renaissance period. We have to internalize this stuff, people. Please bear with me. I'll try to keep this as simple and as interesting as I can. First off, you need to understand that although Karl Marx was full of sheep dip, he did recognize and articulate certain correct and vitally important things about the nature of capitalism. And yes, I know Karl Marx was a Jew. Karl Marx was the son of a rabbi. I know these things. You needn't bother to send me emails telling me all about it. Okay, Marx's analysis of how and why capitalism works is actually pretty much spot on. It's just his solutions that are insane and monstrous. Capitalism is utterly dependent on the exploitation of human beings for their labor. And in order to function, capitalism has to reinvent man as a commodity with assignable value, an economic unit of production and consumption, just as the flip side of the Jewish coin, communism, does. This dehumanizing concept has proven to be one of the most destructive aspects of the Jewish incursion into Western civilization. Secondly, capitalism is dependent for the generation of capital not only on profit, but on the highly cost-effective form of profit known as usury, basically the collection of interest on loaned money. Although there's 101 variations on usury having to do with the stock market and derivatives and hedge funds and God knows what all. Essentially, usury may be defined as the financial art or practice of getting something for nothing, and the Jews are the world's greatest masters of it. For many centuries, usury was forbidden by the church to Christians, which used to be pretty much the same thing as saying Arians. Only Jews were allowed to practice it, and any Arian who was found charging interest was subject to a variety of penalties ranging from fines to the public removal of bits and pieces of the offender's anatomy. Modern-day banks would have you believe that the economy is entirely dependent on the charging of interest, but that's bullshit. The generation of non-production-related profit through interest is actually a fairly recent development in man's economic history. So, how did the economy work in the days before usury? Well, I'm tempted here to give you an example by reading out from an article I wrote many years ago called 14th Century Economic Lesson, but I promised you the Cliff Notes version, and so I'll try to strip it down to basics. But before I do, we're going to go to second music break. This is the Tannehill Weavers. Thank you. It is entirely possible to run a business and run an economy without usury and still to make a profit and have economic growth and produce a decent standard of living for your people and your country. Right now, under usury capitalism, everything is financed with borrowed money, specifically money borrowed at interest. And that's basically the source of this whole crash we've just gone through. The Jew and capitalist bankers took millions of people's mortgages, bundled them up into big job lots, and used all these IOUs as collateral to borrow more money from each other, which they then lent out to more people to create more mortgages, to use as collateral to borrow more money, and so on and so on, ishkabibble. Things have gotten so bad nowadays that no one really knows who owns what property anymore. By the way, here's a hint. If the bank or mortgage company is trying to foreclose on your house, don't just pack up your stuff into a shopping cart and shuffle off into the darkness with your head hung down. Get a lawyer and fight them in court and make them do due diligence. Make them produce the original note in court. In a lot of cases, especially with these shady Jew-run mortgage mills from 8 or 10 years ago, they can't do it because the note's already been sold on and transferred ownership so many times it looks like a chimpanzee went berserk on it with a rubber stamp. The whole subprime mortgage thing is just another form of usury, money producing money out of nothing, money just going round and round and round and never actually producing anything tangible. Now, these mortgages were called subprime because they were lent to niggers and illegal aliens, a lot of whom didn't even have jobs, never mind the capacity to pay their notes back, or else they were lent to various Jewish and Middle Eastern scam artists who brought up hundreds of thousands and maybe millions of subprime properties, ghetto apartment buildings, commercial real estate, foreclosures, whatever, specifically for the purpose of bundling them up, using them for collateral, borrowing millions of dollars on the strength of all this worthless paper, and then skedaddling to Israel. Right now, there is a building boom going on the beachfront in Tel Aviv and other coastal Israeli cities from all these mini Madoffs who are investing their ill-gotten gains in Israeli real estate. I'd be willing to bet that George Soros is in there somewhere. And then, of course, thanks to outsourcing and general capitalist greed and Democrat incompetence, millions of white people lost their jobs and they weren't able to pay their mortgages, which is all that much more useless paper cluttering up the system. The name Bernie Madoff ring any bells? What do you think he used as props in his many investment scams, those financial instruments that were allegedly supposed to be paying all those huge returns and that he used to cover for the fact that he was a Ponzi scheme? More often than not, it was bundled subprime mortgages he bought from shady junk bond bucket shops on Wall Street. Madoff was only doing on his own what Goldman Sachs and Countrywide and Bear Stearns and so on were doing as corporations, and Madoff was just the one who got caught. Now, in the Northwest Republic, we're not going to have all this nonsense because there will be no usury and there will be no mortgages in the American capitalist sense of the term. A mortgage will not involve interest. Interest is prohibited by the Northwest Constitution. A mortgage will basically be a time payment schedule and that's it. And of course, you'll find you pay off your house a hell of a lot quicker if you don't have interest and late penalties compounding all the time. Wandering back onto the subject, if private businesses in the Northwest Republic want to sell shares in their venture based on quarterly or annual division of the profits, i.e. dividends, that's not the same as interest. You sell shares in your venture, your business, whatever, and you agree to pay your investors so much of a percentage of the profits. But that's not interest. That is money that you have earned for yourself and your shareholders by manufacturing and selling your product or whatever it is you do at a profit. And if somebody in the Republic has some money that they want to invest in, say, one of those wineries in Oregon or in a methane-producing pig and chicken farm or whatever, then they go right to the business itself. And they say, hey, how's about you let me in on this to the tune of 100 shares or whatever? There is no need for a stock exchange and a broker who does nothing but shuffle paper and takes a cut off the top. Middlemen of all kinds are the very heart and soul of capitalism, and middlemen of all kinds are what the Republic needs to eliminate. Do you see the difference between this system and Jewish usury? The object of any healthy economy is to manufacture something or import something or build houses, run a bus line, or grow X amount of wine grapes or whatever to provide goods and services, not the manipulation of numbers on a piece of paper. A healthy Aryan economic arrangement is based on productivity for profit, whereas the Jewish usury system is a shell game where money multiplies by itself without relation to anything in the real world. Okay, next email question. This is from Ron in Richmond, Virginia. Dear Harold, did you see an effusion by Tim Wise entitled An Open Letter to the White Right on the occasion of your recent successful temper tantrum? And what do you think of it? Yes, Ron, I saw it. I read the first few paragraphs, and once I got the general drift of it, I quit. I'm not going to go into it at any length because there is only one way that something like that should be answered. And due to our own weakness of character, our lack of moral fiber, and the fact that we've wasted the past 50 years on stupid and pointless dead-end leaders and groups, we're not in a position to do so. Okay, I have to accept that. But I'm not going to add to our contemptible humiliation by wasting time trying to refute or respond to Tim Wise with words. We either respond to something like that with righteousness and justice, or we suffer in silence. If those of you who have read that particular piece are all mad and jumping up and down and you want to do something about it, well, I've already told you what to do about it. Get your ass up here and help us build a new nation among men. Okay, next topic. I hate to spend this whole podcast responding to internet buzz, but that seems to be what's moving people's minds lately. So I've had several emails wanting to know if I think a military coup could save America from Obama. No. For one thing, it'll never happen because there are no officers in the military with the kind of independent mindset necessary for such an undertaking. In the military, anything from captain on above and whatever the equivalent ranks are in the Navy and the Air Force is basically a political appointment. And the higher up the ladder you climb in the military, the harder the resistance gets if you're white and male and if you've shown any tendency towards independent thought or having any opinions on politics at all. The military in America is like the government. By the time you reach the upper levels, you're so completely compromised in any one of a dozen different ways that any bucking of the system is unthinkable. I also question exactly how such a coup would take place and what it would involve. The South American model is for some cabal of colonels to take over the presidential palace. They shoot El Presidente or put him on a plane for Miami if they're feeling kind, and then they rule themselves as a kind of committee until they find that they can't play nice together and they start shooting each other. I don't think that would work here. What about the whole federal bureaucracy? What about the media? What about Goldman Sachs and the Jewish financial establishment? This is one reason that we have to go for a colonial war of liberation here in the Northwest. The United States establishment is simply too damn big to overthrow by force. Suppose the commander of the Delta Force or the 82nd Airborne were to get together a few reliable men, and he was able to somehow get those men up to the Washington, D.C. area and surround the Capitol and the White House and arrest Obama and all the Democratic members of Congress. Or better yet, the whole Congress and the Supreme Court thrown in. Would he have the balls to shoot them? Because you know damn well if you just lock them up, somebody at some point down the line is going to go all squishy and let them go. And after the coup d'etat, what then? How will they govern the country in the face of resistance and abuse from the media and the bureaucracy and the state and local governments that the Democrats have been paying all these years? The military rebels would have to stage mass coordinated raids all across the country and lift thousands of media personalities, bankers, bureaucrats, academics, the whole liberal infrastructure, and who among our military would really have the balls to go ahead and get rid of them? No, they'd be put into these FEMA camps that the government has been building for us, which would be about like a mildly unpleasant summer camp, and like I said, somewhere on down the line, the whole thing would go mushy in the middle, some idiot would let all those snakes go, and forever after we'd be treated to endless concentration camp memoirs from liberals and Democratic politicians. Christ, we have enough of that crap already. We don't need to keep it going for another 70 years. Third music break. I have to be honest, I can't remember offhand if I've ever played this song on this show before or not, but even if so, I'm going to play it again because I just like it. It's kind of the theme song from a really great Irish gangster flick called Departed, a movie that contains the immortal line, "Freud once said that the Irish are the only people in the world who are not susceptible to psychoanalysis." This is the Dropkick Murphys. We'll be right back. I'm going to return briefly now to a subject that I discussed earlier in this podcast, and that is the Occidental Descent comments section, wherein I and the Northwest Migration are being currently attacked and vilified. I suppose I should shut up about it, but I'm sorry, I just gotta say something. I just took a break, and I actually sat down and read the whole string of posts, and I noticed a name in there. A name I haven't heard or thought of in years, but a name I remember from back in the day. Now, as it happens, I know about a string of incidents involving this man in which he behaved in a manner that was nothing short of disgraceful and sick, and he left the movement and disappeared very shortly after. I know because I was peripherally involved in cleaning up his mess. Now, if he thought that I still remembered, he wouldn't dare be posting that crap about me where it might piss me off. Now, either he's forgotten that I know, or he thinks I've forgotten, but I haven't. And you know what I'm going to do about it? Nothing. Because you see, as it happens in real life, I'm not the kind of man he accuses me of being. So far as I know, he's not in any kind of position of responsibility within any white group. He's just posting to a blog, and he has the right to do that, no matter if his posts are meretricious drivel. So long as he's not endangering anyone by reverting to his old ways, I have no interest at all in dragging the skeletons out of his closet. I just had to mention this because of the constant accusation leveled against me that I quote-unquote fight personal feuds with people. No, I don't. I level legitimate criticism against people who do things that bring the cause of the 14 words into disrepute. If I were interested in fighting a feud, I could probably, with a little effort, dig up a couple of internet references, and I could post the URLs in places where all his little intellectual friends on Occidental Descent could see them, but I won't. This man is nobody. His opinions on me or any other subject are worthless. I simply can't be bothered. Moving on to another subject, I want to give all our NF people a warning. Now, we have a project coming up that may finally get us some establishment publicity, if we can play our cards right. And we can do it without standing on a street corner wearing strange garb and without anybody getting killed. Those of you on the Northwest Revolution list will be hearing about this within the week, I hope. I suppose, to be honest, that it does kind of fall into the category of a publicity stunt. Now, it may come to nothing. It may simply be ignored. Or else the regime may hit the roof and send in the FBI to come around to people's doors and do Clint Eastwood impressions. I presume that mine will be the first door they knock on, and if so, it'll be just to try and harass and intimidate me, and that's fine. That's part of my job description, and that's what you guys pay me the big bucks for. They'll be all bluff because there is no way in hell that by even the wildest stretch of a U.S. attorney's imagination this project can be described as a criminal offense. But then one would have thought that posting a poem to the internet wasn't criminal either. Anyway, you guys stand by for a fun new development. I think you'll like it. Well, our time is up now, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.
Beating perfect.